It's Will Sean Podcast. The internet cried out for two more blowhards, and they courageously answered that call. Armed with the weapon of wit, each week they're joined by guests to discuss movies, television, pop culture, and anything else that's pissing them off. Take it away, boys.
I'm Will Link.
And I'm Sean David.
And this is Will Sean Podcast?
1 week at a time, 1 month at a time, 1 year at a time. God help us. How you doing, Will?
So, I spoke a few weeks ago about how I was set up on this blind date. And it was a truly blind date. We hadn't seen even a photo of each other's, and which doesn't happen in this day and age. And now more than ever, I realize we were only set up because the girl who set us up, we are the only two non-Jews that she knows. It's like when you're like, oh, I have a gay friend, you have a gay friend. I have a Gentile friend, Gentile friend.
But how did it go?
Oh, it didn't go well.
Okay.
We had nothing in common, as I suspected. But
other than your worship of Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior?
See, the thing is, well, see, that's the thing. It's like,
or was she Muslim?
That might have been better. She didn't have any of the same interests as me. And I need a girl, like, if you met a girl who liked John Waters movies and loved podcasting,
you're afraid she'd take a shit on my chest while I was sleeping.
Set her up with me. If you meet a girl who hates movies and believes in God, then don't set her up in me. That said, the same girl is trying to set me up on another blind date
with a girl
that she met only one time. So this will go well as well.
Perfect. Well, I look forward to hearing all about that.
And you'll hear about it right here, I'm sure. What's going on in the world of Will Sean Podcast?
It's our 75th episode, our quarter quell. Yes, we've been doing this for about 77 weeks. I think we're like Stephen King. We only took off for Christmas.
We only took off for Christmas. We're very committed.
We're very diligent. And just a few plugs. Want to remind you all that Alex M. Stein's book, No Mr. Bond, I Expect Your Dreams to Die, is now available on Amazon for purchase.
And two-time guest of the podcast.
Yes, and Man of Mead. And there is an introduction to Alex Stein's book by Man of Mystery Dylan Brody, who we will speak to shortly. So wanted to let you all know that. Liz Feamy has one more performance of her show, Take Me to the Poorhouse. It was extended as part of the
Of Hollywood Fringe Fest.
Festival.
This is why was it extended? Because it is a great fucking show, and you should go see it. There's one more show, July 26th. I'm telling you, it's good.
Listen
to us.
And finally, The Road to 222. Keep those likes coming. Facebook, iTunes, Twitter. You know the drill.
If you don't buy now, find us on iTunes and click on the little star buttons. Give us 5 stars. Do we deserve 5 stars? I think so. And who is our sponsor this week?
Well, Will, in honor of our quarter quell, this episode has been brought to you by the following people who died at the age of 75. Harpo Marx, Dizzy Gillespie, Timothy Leary, Roy Scheider, Leonid Brezhnev, Dom DeLuise, Vaclav Havel, and Edith Wharton.
So if we die on this episode, we're in good company. We're in Harpo Marx company.
We're in Harpo Marx and Vaclav Havel. You know, he was responsible for the Velvet Revolution.
Well, on the show today, why can't people quit Twitter? Why can't we quit Twitter? There was a trial in Florida. I don't know if you heard about it. We may get into it. And we are under the tyranny of very tiny people, and I'm going to explain my thoughts on that. But first, our guest today, a writer, comedian, storyteller, radio wit, a man of peace, poker, and martial arts, Dylan Brody.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
Now, I thought Lou Reed was responsible for the Velvet Revolution.
Well, that was the Velvet Underground.
Oh,
I think
thank
they
you.
Were fighting thank against
you.
The Velvet Revolution.
I understand.
They ended up winning, actually.
Yes, they did.
I see.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. The studio is beautiful. I was hanging out in the green room earlier with your assistant, and she's just terrific.
She's great. She's the best. That's why we keep her on. Andrea Marchant, our assistant.
Is the assistant.
She's phenomenal. She does a great job. Well, thank you so much for coming. And
I haven't yet, but I'll let you know if I do.
Thank
you.
I'll
be here for the next however many minutes this takes. Go ahead.
It's a four-hour show.
Oh, cool. Go ahead.
It's a tantric podcast.
Good. I feel that what you want to go for in podcasts, in lieu of quality, just quantity.
It's like Wagner. It's an endurance situation.
By the way, I liked it when you were recommending the play that has been extended earlier, and you said, "Listen to us," which is the funniest thing to say when you're doing an audio-only podcast.
We are convinced that people are listening to us.
But they're not really listening to us.
It's the transitive versus the intransitive.
In 1999, I worked for Anti.com, which was to be the next big thing in video. The premise was it was anti-Hollywood. It was going to be, people would send us literally VHS tapes, and we would digitize them and put them on the web.
Uh-huh.
And we were YouTube before YouTube existed. Nobody could upload their own stuff. You had to have someone digitize it and put it up for you. And it was going to be entirely populist, democratic, and people would choose their favorite ones, and then we would make pilots out of the ones that they liked. It was a brilliant thing, but nobody had the bandwidth, so there was a lot of buffering involved. And at one of the huge staff meetings, the head of the company said, "I don't know what we're going to do. I don't think this is working. We might have to go to audio only." And I got a huge laugh saying, "Yes, radio, the way of the future." And as it turns out, I'm now doing like 4 podcasts every week with people, because radio is the way of the future.
Everybody has a podcast. People seem to love listening to them.
I think.
Or something.
Or people like making them.
I'm a little bit afraid that there are like 4 people who love listening to them and just listen to all of them, and I just keep hearing the same people.
We, those 4 are certainly loyal listeners of ours. Though.
Excellent.
So you are reaching out to them today. Now, I introduced you with many different things because you have done many different things. You've been part of many. And one thing, we met you and know you as a storyteller.
Yes, but that is what I say on my business card, is that I'm a storyteller and a humorist.
But you started as more just a straight stand-up comic.
For 15 years, I was a straight-ahead political stand-up comic, far left-leaning, topical, touring the country, being a road warrior comic, and was deeply disillusioned by it all. And I was a comic for 15 years. I took 10 years off when I went into a depression, and one of many depressions. I went into a depression, went into therapy, started martial arts, quit smoking cigarettes, quit smoking pot, and didn't know how to perform. I didn't know who I was anymore, so I needed some time away from it. And then stumbled into storytelling, and when I was writing these stories and doing them on the radio, and suddenly went, oh, I could perform again. Oh, that'd be good. And I started performing.
So this wasn't necessarily a planned transition.
No, it was the confluence of the process of writing the stories and reading them into a microphone and the jonesing for performance time, which caused me to read them into a microphone in front of people.
Now, this seems like an interesting transition that...
I'll be the judge of that.
Well, yes, you will.
That's why you're here.
You start out, okay, so as a comedian, your primary currency is jokes. You get up there, you're making...
Yes.
You're making jokes, and it's entertainment, and you're there for a laugh.
Let me interrupt for a second.
Yes.
Part of the reason that I became disillusioned, and part of the reason that I am still disillusioned to some degree... Well, I'm disillusioned. I no longer have the illusion with which I went into it. I went into it as an art, not as entertainment. I always believed that comedy was the one place where, as long as you were funny, you could say anything you believed, you could present any vision of the world, and if you were funny enough, you would find success.
Right.
As it turns out, entertainment is the word people use when they don't want to take responsibility for what they say through their art.
Okay.
And entertainment is a commodity that is traded in the entertainment industry, which has nothing to do with art. So I would go on the road, and I had, for instance, several minutes of material on the Marijuana Tax Act and why marijuana was illegal and how absurd it is that marijuana is illegal. And club owners would ask me not to do that material because they were trying to sell drinks.
Right.
They didn't recognize that as censorship because it was purely mercenary. And also at the time, it was politically unfavorable to say that.
That's why I use, specifically, you said commodity. It's why I use the word currency. What you're getting at is also something that I've noticed in a lot of other comedians and myself and Will Love is that it's a transition from entertainment to rhetoric. You look at the transition of like George Carlin or Cosby, and it's where they go to that point where they move into that storyteller phase. They move into more of the long form, because when I think of George Carlin, especially his later years, he was doing comedy through...
I understand what you're trying to articulate.
How do you get to the art point?
I don't know that Carlin really changed that much in his form. Even early when he felt the need and the pressure to be funny all the time, which he lost later on because he was well enough established that he had an audience and he had ticket sales regardless of how funny he was. And he's one of my heroes, and there was a span that he was not funny. There was a span when he was angry.
Was that before the HBO specials really took? Because I always think of him as like...
Well, I remember his second to last HBO special. I can't remember what it was called, but I remember watching it and being a little like, I was more depressed after it than I was before that.
He went through waves.
Yeah.
There were times when he was hilarious, and there were times when he was angry, and there were times when he was depressed. He changed from time. But he always worked in sort of long form. He always worked in linguistic rhythms. He had a very keen sense of who he was.
Right.
So, I think he always treated it as an art form. When I look at my heroes in the comedy world, they are the ones who treated it as an art. Whether they were politically motivated or not, they had a vision and an idea and something that they wanted to express. Bob Newhart is an artist. He's not an entertainer. He's damned entertaining. But he approaches it from a particular point of view and a particular structure, and it's gorgeous to watch every time. Whereas I think of Carrot Top as an entertainer. He has nothing to say. He is not actually presenting a particular vision of the world.
No point of view.
I will have no one come on this podcast and insult prop comedy.
Gallagher 1 or 2.
Do you know who Lenny Schultz is or was?
No.
Lenny Schultz, you guys are young. Lenny Schultz is a comic, a prop comic. He had a Saturday morning live action show, I believe. It might have been a cartoon show called Super Chicken in the 70s.
Yeah.
And then didn't anymore.
And Adult Swim hasn't picked this up
yet.
And
continued
it
to be. They do Bionic Chicken now. And he did all over the he continued to headline all over the country. And he had two trunks full of stuff. And one of them had props of various sorts in it. And one of them had stuffed and sculptural pigs of various sorts. And he would get the audience to shout, "More shit, Lenny," or "More pigs, Lenny." And whatever they shouted more of, he would just pull something out of it, and he would do his joke, and then he would move on to the next thing with the audience shouting. It was pretty much his whole shtick. And Jay Leno, before he took over The Tonight Show, and before he was even doing just the Monday nights, but before he had really given into entertainment industry as opposed to comedy. He apparently was featuring, so that's how long ago it was, for Lenny Schultz. And Lenny Schultz shows up with his station wagon and pulls out his trunks full of stuff. And Jay looked down at him and said, "So, Lenny, you write all this stuff yourself?" Which is just genius, in my mind. I will insult any damn prop comic I want, as well as any guitar act I want.
What about a magician comedian?
If they have a point of view and something to say, absolutely.
Well, who's somebody now, then, that you really like, then, or you see that kind of maybe... I don't want to necessarily say George Carlin because there's only one George Carlin, but that kind of thing.
What Lee Camp is doing. Look at Lee Camp. He's a wonderful young comic. Look at Jamie Kilstein and the work that he's doing. He writes jokes that are poetry.
Jamie Kilstein sounds like an SS officer.
Or a Bond villain.
Yeah, Kilstein.
No, he is so such a smart kid. He's so funny, and there are a few of them that are young and working hard that I love. And then, you know, there's a kid named Zach Kahn, who I'm going to be using in an audio pilot that I'm recording next month, who is in the Steve Wright vein.
Interesting. Oh, nice.
Who does these surreal one-liners that I love. There are a lot of people who are finding their way up through the ranks now and having difficulty. Mark Maron. Mm-hmm. I mean, Mark Maron is doing some really interesting self-exploratory stuff. And then at the high end, Louis C.K.,
who is
really finding the success that he deserves for doing the soul-searching work and continuing to produce and not just resting on his laurels with a special that he's then going to tour forever, but writing new stuff every year and
the show and everything.
The show. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on in the world right now.
Now, I guess my question is, so you spent all this time as a comic. Did you find, like, what's the approach to building a story that you're going to go out there and tell as opposed to when you were building, like, a comedic set?
Oh, what a great question. When I was building a stand-up piece, you can tell it's a great question. You can't hear this on the podcast, but I sat forward so that I could use my hands. When I was building a stand-up piece, and I told this to everybody who ever came to me for instruction in how to write comedy, anyone who wanted me to write for them, I would say, no, I will teach you how, unless they had a pile of money, and then I would say, yes, I will write for you. The approach with stand-up to me was always figure out what you want to say. Set aside the question of what is funny. Set aside the question of how does a joke work. Start from what you want to say. And write that as an essay. And as you write that, take time to think that you are talking to an idiot who disagrees with you. And now how are you going to defend your point and make them look foolish? And if you can make your point and make them look foolish, you're writing jokes.
Oh,
and you're going to be golden. And that was how I wrote most of my material. Now, because I was political and topical, frequently I would have a piece that would grow over time. I would have a segment, and then something new would happen in the news that changed my take on it slightly or that changed the situation. And then it would be great, because then I could say, so this happened in the news, do today's joke, and then move through everything I had come up with to that point on it, and it created the illusion that I had this new series of thoughts based on today's news, when in fact, this was, you know, started with a joke 6 months ago, developed over time as new things happened, and, you know, kept rearranging and loosely format
created
until,
an organic
boom, today,
structured all of it.
Today it's coming out of this. So that's how I would structure stand-up stuff. Now, doing the stories is very different for me. Partly because I am so thoroughly an instinctive writer that when I have a new story, there's two things that go. First of all, sometimes I sit down and write them first, which I almost never did as a comic. I never sat down and said, I need 12 minutes on the George Zimmerman case. I will write that now. You know, it was not like that. It was like my first thought on it on the day that it came out in the news would be an opening line. Because, you know, this just, you know, guy just got shot for carrying Skittles, you know, and now that there, I got a joke on that, I'm going to open with that, and then move into stuff. And then as it continued to have a life, the piece would continue to grow. But I never sat down and went, I need 12 minutes on that. Sometimes I will sit down and say, I'm doing a show, I got 8 minutes, I promised them I would have something brand new. What have I got? When I'm writing for KPCC, I sit down, I say, I got 500 words maximum, and I want the check. I want to submit something because I need a check. I'll write that amount of space. And I start from the beginning, and I through write, and I find out where the story takes me, and I instinctively know how to structure it to get where I'm going by the end. And then I look at it, and I say, is there anything I can clean up? Is there a sentence here that seems boring where I can write in a better verb? Is there is there a sentence that runs for a paragraph that I can break into four sentences? Oh, now that I've broken it into four sentences, I've got jokes I can put in. And, you know, that kind of thing happens. When I'm doing the stories that I tell now for performance, frequently, and if you want, there's one that I'm working on currently that I would love to tell you guys if you're interested, but frequently it comes from, I've got an idea. And I know there are these elements of the story that I want to hit. And And I'll do this whether I write it out at the computer first or I'm developing it in my head as I am with this new piece called Name the Demon. The first time I'm going to perform it live, I have a list of people who let me read to them on the phone. And okay. I call the first six, and if it's a written piece, I call the first six and I read it to them. And I make notes as I go, and I do rewrites and fixes. Oh, I can't do that sentence in one
or
breath.
Or as you say it out, glad as you I realize, read it, oh, that doesn't work.
Yeah, I'm making notes for myself. And then after the five of them, I do the changes that I know I need to do in the computer. And I reprint it, and I set it to the side, and I call the next five or seven on the list. And to them, I tell it while glancing down just to see what the next thought is if I get lost. And after each one, I go through to see if I left out any great turns of phrase, any important images that I wanted. And by the time I've done those, I've got the thing pretty solidly in my head. And then I call the next five on the list and do it without letting myself look.
What if you don't have 15 friends?
I have a list of about 30 beta testers who let me call them.
Okay.
In your case, you would just have to call your mom over and over again.
It's true.
Again.
She doesn't want to hear anybody.
To be fair, I might be willing to listen.
Okay. But this is fascinating because you then go through the entire process from conception to committing it to memory, and you're workshopping it simultaneously.
And when I go on stage, I give myself the freedom to leave anything out or put anything in so that I don't punish myself afterwards. I have a very good memory for my own performances.
Yes.
So on the way home, I'll frequently go, oh, you left out the line about.
Yeah.
And I try not to get too upset. The only time I get really upset about that is when it winds up on a CD.
Okay.
And that there's been something like that on every CD I've recorded thus far. And I just allow that to be the Persian flaw, as it were.
I've been getting into, and we were talking about this a little bit off air, how I've been getting into the essay reading and stuff like that. And I've seen you perform at the best show, and I can't imagine, like, memorizing the things, like, because you seem to have it down to the word, and even if you're forgetting something, you sell it really well, because that's the thing. I know I would drive myself insane in the moment. Maybe I wouldn't. Maybe I should try it. That I would drive myself insane knowing I missed something.
May I answer just for that? I think it's because you probably have more hours of stage experience than Will does.
I don't have that much. I've only done it maybe 5-6 times
so far. I have my 10,000 hours.
Well, there you go.
And it really is a thing that you have to do a lot to get used to it. I know it sometimes looks as though I'm not comfortable on stage because I sweat like Chris Christie putting on his socks. But the truth is, I sweat a lot because I'm on Paxil. I am so relaxed and comfortable on stage that I am able... Well, you mentioned at the beginning of the show that I'm also a martial artist. I was the voice of the martial arts studio that I trained and taught at for years. Anytime there was a test or a tournament or what have you, I would be the guy who spoke on behalf of the studio and made... because my master is first-generation Korean, and he has a thick accent and doesn't feel he knows the language well enough. And I am so comfortable in front of people that I am able to turn even the instructions to a bunch of students who are testing into casual performance. I understand projection and physical comfort and the relationship between individual and crowd. So I want to say instinctively now, but instinctively isn't right because I didn't when I started.
It's learned.
What?
It's learned.
It's learned. I have internalized it so thoroughly now that I do it at least what seems effortlessly.
Okay. As a point of contrast, the first time I went up on stage and ever performed anything that was not a eulogy or a speech in honor of my parents, I had this essay. Well, I got up there. I was ready to go. I had rehearsed it. And I got up on stage, did not realize, one, that I would not be able to see the audience because of the lights, and two, how warm it would be up there. So I just took a deep breath, and I just slipped into members it how I had practiced it, and I was fine. But I realized it was just such a shock to get up there and go, oh, I can't see anyone, and it's hot.
Yeah.
And there was this split second of panic, and then I just, okay, I can do this. And
yeah,
it was fine. But I can imagine after doing that 10,000 times, it's very easy.
Yeah. It's very easy, and some, you know, the way it feels in front of a 30-seat room is different from the way it feels in front of a 500-seat room is different from the way it feels in front of a 1,500-seat amphitheater. It's 1,500 seat amphitheater. That's kind of funny. An actual amphitheater.
A 22 bench amphitheater.
Yeah, exactly. But the distance changes the dynamic. The numbers change the dynamic, and the performance process remains exactly the same.
Okay.
Because it's all about being here in this moment right now, knowing what I am here with that is prepared, knowing how free I am to work off the cuff if I need to.
Right.
Knowing that I have earned the right to be there, that the audience wants the thing I am offering them. I don't need to prove to them that I am worthy. And now it is this interaction between individual and group.
That's fascinating.
Boy, I hope so.
No, I do. I find that whole idea fascinating.
Now, I want to ask you also, because you have many things to plug, and we're going to get to some, but I want to ask you because you have a new book, a new novel.
Yes.
Laughs Last.
Correct. Laughs Last, just released by Wilman Press. Small publisher. It is not vanity published. It is not subsidy published, but it is a small publisher. And I am more proud of this book. I have, understand, 5 CDs out with stand-up records. I have a play that has won awards. I have a screenplay that is being shot in the... I have a lot of written material that I put out over the years. There is nothing of which I am more proud than this novel. It is about a comic and his relationship with his grandfather. It is not autobiographical.
Oh, okay. There goes that question.
I get tired of that question, actually. That's why I headed it off, because everyone assumes it must be.
So it's called fiction.
And it very isn't. I don't give the lead character a lot of the difficulties that I had as a professional comic. I allow him to be far more comfortable in that role than I ever was. My grandfather did not really teach me about comedy. My relationship with my family is not exactly what is presented in the book. But it's a very funny, very sweet book. The grandfather is the grandfather I wish I had had.
Okay.
Right.
There's a funny story, I hope, about when I first wrote it, I gave it to my former manager and said, read this. I know you don't like reading prose, but read this. If it'll make you feel more comfortable, pretend it's a movie and pretend the grandfather is played by Carl Reiner. And 3 weeks later, I called and I said, did you read the book? And he said, no, but I did what you said. I sent that script of yours to Carl Reiner. See, there are reasons. He's my former manager. And I said, okay, that's not what I said. And he said, oh, well, what's the movie about? I said, it's not a movie. It's a book. Read the book. And then a few more weeks went past, and I got a lovely note in the mail from Carl Reiner that said, what a wonderful book, and it's got a terrific punchline. Uh-huh. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And I sent him a note back thanking him for the lovely words. And then a few weeks later, I had one of those days when it feels like my career is going nowhere and nobody loves me. And my
None
manager,
of us ever have any of those.
My manager's just like, oh, my mood can spiral like Larry Flint at the Guggenheim. So I called Carl Reiner's office. And I said, hi, this is Dylan Brody. I have a meeting in Beverly Hills tomorrow. Lie. I had no meeting. I had nothing. I have a meeting in Beverly Hills. I think I said next week. I wonder if I might be able to take Carl out for lunch. Thank him for that lovely card. And his assistant said, I'm going to need to call you back. And I said, okay. And 20 minutes later, the phone rang. And the assistant said, hi, Mr. Brody, I have Carl Reiner on the line for you, if you're available. And I was. I turned down Batman the Animated Series, and I said, hello, Mr. Reiner. And he said, what do you want from me now? And I said, I don't want anything from you. I'm going to be in Beverly Hills on Wednesday. I wonder if I could take you out for lunch. And he said, oh, no, don't take me out for lunch. Come by the house. And I said, oh, okay. What time is your thing? I should be done by 11:30. Yeah, after you're done, just come by the house. Oh, okay, I said. I don't have that address. Talk to my assistant. She'll give you all the... The assistant gave me the address. I went by the house. And I went into Carl Reiner's house, which is already confusing, because I'm going into Carl Reiner's house, and he lives in a house like a person. And he looks like Carl Reiner, only older. And we sat down on his... I sat on his couch, and he sat, and I brought him scotch. He said, put it up there with all the other scotch. I don't drink, and people bring me scotch. Which made me want to say, well, can I keep it then? Yeah. I bought you good scotch. I did not say that. I put it on the shelf. I went and sat with him. And it was he was very sweet. He was a very sweet man. I said, you know, Mr. Reiner, this is the... It is always a joy when I get to meet one of my heroes, and they are not a disappointment. And like anybody else on the planet, he leaned forward and said, oh, tell me about the disappointments. And I said, well, Steve, I worked for Steve Allen for a while, and he was crazy and angry and difficult to work with. He said, oh, he was so nice to me and Mel when we were young. He produced the first 2,000-year-old man album. He didn't take any of it. He just heard us do it at a party, and he said, we got to record this, and he produced it for us, and he let us take all the money. He was so nice to us. Boy, I hope when I get old I don't get angry and crazy. Carl, you're 112. Yeah. You're doing okay. And this is the part that just kills me. He said, I just got the illustrations back from my next kid's book. And he had written this book called Tell Me a Scary Story. Might have been Tell Me Another Scary Story.
Okay.
And he'd gotten the illustrations back. So he had the galleys unbound with the picture. He pulls them out of this stiff manila envelope, and he sits down on the couch next to me. And he reads me a children's book. And he points things out in the pictures. Oh, see, there's the cat coming in for the party, he's saying as he points it. And I am sitting after, you know, 2 months after saying to my manager, imagine the grandfather is played by Carl Reiner. I'm sitting on the couch and Carl Reiner is reading me a children's book.
Wow.
If there were a virtual reality ride designed for me, I would ask to do the setting where it seems like Carl Reiner is reading me a children's book. And now that has happened in actual living reality. So I would have to do it on the setting where it seems as though Groucho Marx is teaching me to tie my shoes.
Wow.
And the grandfather in my novel is the repository of everything I wish someone had told me before I got into stand-up.
Okay.
So through the book, he's dead by the beginning of the book, but the
spoiler
book, like,
alert.
Like almost everything I do is told all out of order.
Okay. Okay.
Because I believe that life is a series of Russian nesting dolls, and that the present is only given shape by one's history. So the book is told all out of order, and it all makes sense by the end, and I love the man I created in that book more than I have ever loved any human being in my life.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
That's...
If you want to read about this grandfather, about this wonderful human being...
Laughs Last.
Laughs Last, available on Amazon and anywhere books are available.
Barnes & Noble online, Amazon. You can go to your bookstore and have them order it because it is distributed by Ingram.
Ingram.
It will not already be in the bookstore, but I do not object to you having your bookstore order it for you.
Support what is a bookstore?
Support your mom and pop bookstore.
That's
which
correct.
There might be
Barnes & Noble.
I know. You know, it's sad that I was somewhere yesterday where there used to be a Barnes & Noble, and I had time to kill, and I'm like, oh, if only there was this Barnes & Noble still here.
That was not Barnes & Noble. That was Borders.
It was the Barnes & Noble.
Was it?
No, at the West Side Pavilion.
It was at the West Side Pavilion. And it always used to be great because I'd go see a movie at the Landmark, and if I had time to kill, oh, I'll buy a book or browse some books or do something involving reading. And
well,
now
you have an iPhone. You don't need books.
Oh, yeah, instead, I just sent a lot of tweets in that
you
amount
just
of time.
Drove a spike into my solar plexus.
Hopefully you could have heard this.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you have like a Kindle or anything? Do you still buy a book? Because I still like to hold a physical book.
I bought a book actually 20 minutes before I arrived here to do the podcast.
Oh.
Yes, I buy books, I read books, and then I keep them on shelves.
Yes.
I have not made the transition to electronic readery yet. I like the smell of books.
Yeah.
You're like me. You're the same.
I like same way. I go a lot to this cafe in Studio City Aroma, and I like to sit there, and I like to read a book, and I would feel like an asshole if I'm holding a tablet and scrolling through a tablet reading
Plus
it instead of turning a page.
You can't judge people based on what they're reading if they're all just holding a tablet.
Exactly. I am willing to be judged.
I had a horrible moment about 6 months ago. Somebody said, I think it's so cute that you still wear a watch. Which I have a lot of affectations, but that wasn't one of them.
And you're not wearing one now.
I am not wearing one now.
You were shamed from then.
All of my watches have died. I need to just buy new batteries for them now. But partly I realized I don't need to get the new batteries because I have a phone and nobody wears watches anymore. And I realized, oh, that's kind of antiquated and silly. So when that watch battery died, I stopped wearing the watch. And then that week, I was meeting someone at Aroma, oddly enough, and I was reading when he arrived. He said, "That's so funny, you still buy books." Like, for the love of God.
Even when we had Alex Stein on a few weeks ago, he had emailed us a copy of his book before it came out because he wanted to read it, come on. And I even printed it out because I so much wanted to at least... I knew I would enjoy it more just by being able to hold it and flip through pages.
His book is wonderful.
Enjoyed it. Yeah, I really
enjoyed it. And we've talked about it. It's a fantastic book.
I was actually with someone last night, having dinner with someone who bought it based off of our recommendation.
Oh,
I'd
love to
hear that. So it's very good.
Alex, I love Alex. Alex also will be on my show, by the way. I mentioned Zach Kahn is doing this thing that I'm recording.
You know what? Why don't we, because we eventually are, I could honestly listen to you talk all day, but we are going to have to move to some topics at some point because that's
you
what we
make
do.
A lot of rules, man.
I know. Those are the only rules. But why don't you tell us about that and give us some more of your plugs where people can find
I will run through a ton of plugs really fast.
And we'll do them again at the end.
And we'll do them again. I have 5 CDs out with Stand Up Records, all available at Amazon or as downloads at iTunes. The most recent one is Writ Large. I urge you to get the whole albums. When you buy individual tracks, I do things that call back from one piece to another over the course of a CD. I create full CDs. I do not create little segments. And don't put it on shuffle. Just listen to a CD, for the love of God. I keep saying for the love of God as if I believe in such a being.
Gotta say something.
Tomorrow I'm at a poker game. Thursday...
This Thursday... The podcast won't be up yet.
Will it be up Friday?
It'll be up Friday night.
Okay. You just missed a reading of my play. August 10th at... Coffee Gallery backstage in Altadena at 3 in the afternoon, $10 to get in. I am hosting an audio recorded pilot that I'll be taking to NPR and failing that to Pacifica and failing that anywhere else I can think of, called Dylan Brody's Hacking Hollywood, because there is a great deal of talent in Hollywood that never reaches the surface because it is more interested in doing the work of the artist than it is in sucking up to the entertainment industry. On that show, Zach Kahn, whom I mentioned earlier on this podcast, Alex Stein, whom we mentioned earlier on this podcast and who is also producing it with me, Cynthia Carl, who is a wonderful, funny musician and songwriter, and Andy Sell, who is a poet ordinaire. That's wrong. A poet extraordinaire. He's also a comic, but his poetry is the next evolution beyond Bukowski. He is so funny and smart and lovely. And in between all of those, I will be serving as host and MC. I will tell at least one story. My musical director is Gary Stockdale. August 10th, 3 p.m., Coffee Gallery backstage. Come to that. There are other things that happen between now and then. Just go to dylanbrody.com, and you can generally find just about anything I'm doing.
And if you are a good listener of the podcast, know you are, you've already been to dylanbrody.com because we have it linked on our Facebook page.
I like if you are a good listener, as though you judge the quality of your various listeners.
We do. This is an ongoing thing with me. where I do judge the quality of our listeners.
Well, good
and
for you.
And they seem to like me for it. I wanted to ask you one quick question right before we go to the topics. You are a master, according to...
That is correct.
You're a master of several forms of East Asian martial arts. So basically, if me and Sean came at you right now, we're dead, right? You take us out.
Well, now that you've warned me... actually, carefully, no. No,
we got a shot. Surviving this episode.
You don't have a shot, but I would not kill either or both of you. Okay. I am, in fact, a Taekwondo master, which is to say fourth Dan black belt. I am a Hapkido instructor with a third Dan black belt. I have a first Dan black belt in Kikumdo, which is a Korean sword style. I've done a little bit of Wing Chun. I've done a little bit of Wushu. I've done a little bit of a lot of things. So, yes, I am a Taekwondo master, officially. And I've done also a lot of Western sword styles, both stage combat and proper combat training. And if you guys attacked me... neither of you would come out of it feeling as though you had won.
probably because we would have lost.
But I would see no reason to kill you, as I do not even a little bit feel as though you are a threat to my life.
I am not.
Neither am I.
We are not very physically imposing men.
And also, let me say, why would you attack me?
Well, you know.
Zombie rage.
Oh, if it was zombie rage, I would.
Then
I
we
would,
got to head
your head's
coming. Paradigm shift.
I do not mess around with the zombies.
Well, you know, we did promise our listeners that you may kill us on this episode.
I
but
will
it's not.
Not.
Happen.
Okay. I will not.
Fair enough. Sorry, guys.
We break our promises.
Well, you are on Twitter.
Not right now. Right now, I'm in the room with you.
You've given us your full attention.
I strive to be present.
Well, someone who might not have always been present, because he was on Twitter a lot, is Alec Baldwin. And last week, Alec Baldwin said, that's it, I'm quitting Twitter. He had been at James Gandolfini's funeral, and he said, Gandolfini never needed to be on Twitter to be popular and beloved. Everyone loved him. I don't need to be on Twitter. He's like, I'm getting off of this. Now, here's the thing.
It's his third time kicking Twitter.
He's not, you can't, he's addicted to that. He is not going to, he's going to be back, right? He's
what
gonna
I
back.
Find hilarious about this is that Alec Baldwin feels competitive with James Gandolfini over how popular he is and how he got that way.
It was just that week Gandolfini happened to be trending more. I wonder why. And, you know, I've noticed this with Twitter. You have these celebrities who go on there and they implode, be it your Kanye Wests or your Amanda Bynes's, and they say, well, I'm quitting Twitter, and then they come right back. So why do they feel this thing? Like, what is about Twitter? Because I'll tell you what. I'm a little Twitter addicted, and I didn't really have a social media footprint until I joined Twitter, and I tweet constantly.
There is something that is very soothing about knowing that you can talk to 10 or 100 or 1,500, or if you've got an amphitheater,
22
you know,
rows.
2,200 people. there is something lovely about knowing I can just get this out to all those people this fast, this effortlessly.
But because it's the barrier to entry is so low, that's how these celebrities primarily get themselves into trouble. And is this something that they will just have to learn how to manage? To just you kind of have to learn the rules of this new medium.
The world is changing very, very fast in terms of interpersonal communication. And it used to be that, you know, Lana Turner worked at the movie studio all day and then went to her private home. And if there was going to be any communication with the world at large, one reporter would come to her home, would interview her, and then the publicists from her studio would sit them down and say, okay, don't say that. She didn't say that.
Don't talk about her gangster boyfriend.
Yeah, we're changing this. And then a very, you know, carefully fashioned image would go out to the world. And with television, it began to change, because now you've got John Wayne going on I Love Lucy, yeah. and you're starting to see a little bit behind the scenes what's going on in the movie industry. And now there's direct access.
Yeah.
And
unmediated access.
Exactly,
and
right.
You get Amanda Bynes wanting Drake to murder her vagina. That's what you get on Twitter.
First of all, let me say that is one of the most intriguing images of 2013 thus far.
It's, I don't know if it's performance art. I don't know if this is like Joaquin Phoenix doing his crazy man act,
no,
or if she's having a meltdown.
She's having some sort of a meltdown. It's hard to know how big a meltdown it is, because she's expressing it 140 characters at a time. So, you know, it may just be that she's blurting stuff out when she's drunk, and, you know, and it's not really a meltdown, it's just that she's occasionally a drunk, and she blurts stuff out.
Yeah.
But she's a kid, and she's so young. She, you know, she grew up with, to some extent, internet connectivity.
Yeah.
And you feel as though everybody's your close friend.
Right.
And it's very confusing.
You're telling me my Twitter followers are not my close friends?
You can't call them to tell them a story. I know that much. You can't call them to get notes on a story.
Nah, you're right. This is true. I could tweet it 144 characters at a time.
If they are following you closely,
yes.
Do not turn around and ask them what they're doing, or they are allowed to shoot you.
Yeah, that's true. And we'll get to that.
Yes.
Have you ever gotten... But you've given me the perfect transition, and yet I have one more thing I want to ask you about Twitter. Have you ever gotten in trouble on Twitter? Have you ever tweeted something that then was like... Because Sean got in a little trouble a few weeks ago tweeting something. I have not gotten in trouble, although I've gotten into heated Twitter arguments over the death penalty with people. But that's another story. I sought that trouble. But... And it's not even trouble. But have you gotten into, like... Have you tweeted something that you were like... Oh, shit, maybe I shouldn't have tweeted that, ever?
No. I tend to think before I type. I do suffer from comedy Tourette's, so... There's always the danger that I'll do a too-soon thing. But everybody who knows me, who actually knows me, sort of knows that about me. And frequently I will couch things so that it's very clear that I know I'm treading dangerous ground. Right after the tornado in Oklahoma City, like the day of the tornado in Oklahoma City, I tweeted something to the effect of, just so I don't lose followers, somebody tell me when it is no longer too soon to start doing Wind Comes Sweeping Down the Plains jokes. It's like, I got it. I want to be the first, but I don't want to be the dick.
Well, it was after, you know, the tsunami. The joke was not too tsunami.
Oh, yeah, nice.
Too tsunami to make a joke.
That was the one that got Gilbert Gottfried in trouble. That's one that lost him.
Ironically, it wasn't his
deal.
Voice that got him in trouble.
I love him. I used to watch him when I was 17, and I just started doing stand up in New York. I used to watch him, and he was brilliant.
So, how many days before Baldwin's back on Twitter?
I give it a good couple months.
Ah.
Yeah, because he's got a wife, he's got a new kid, he's busy. And
2.5 weeks.
I give him before this podcast is even up.
All right.
Okay. I have no faith in the man to hold out.
I'll ask him in the chat window during one of our Words with Friends games.
There you go. He couldn't turn off the thing on an airplane. He's going to be able to stay off Twitter. I don't buy it. But you made an excellent joke before about that's not... You know, we try to keep things light here, but we had a topic in the rundown, which was kind of the idea of trials becoming entertainment with cameras in the courtroom, and how this George Zimmerman trial was almost a must-see TV of the summer so far.
750,000 people watched the verdict.
I mean, it's crazy.
But, no, I'm sorry, 11 million. Why did I say 750,000?
I don't know.
11 million people watched the verdict.
Let it go.
No, yeah, it was 11 million people watched the verdict.
You know what's ironic? I had been in doing some writing and some work all day, and I had MSNBC on in the background, and all day they're saying, oh, they're deliberating. So I was going to a triple feature that night at the New Beverly, and I got in my car, and I'm driving, and literally I'm in the car for 10 minutes, and I get a text from a friend who's like, the verdict's in. And I'm like, oh, this whole time. And I actually, I went to this triple feature, and I was annoyed with the verdict. And then I saw three Danish drug dealer movies in a row. And I walked...
Oh, you went to the Danish Drug Dealer Festival.
Yes.
How was that?
Oh, it was phenomenal. Next year, you should go.
Excellent. Okay.
But a great double feature with current Belgian cinema that they do with the Arrow.
Beautiful.
But I walked out of it, and it was like 2 in the morning. I got
home. Any good Hanna Shigula films playing?
Don't talk poorly about my Hanna Shigula. I love her. I'm a Fassbinder.
Everyone loves Hanna Shigula. How do you not love Hanna Shigula?
So I get home, and that's when it really kind of sunk in. What happened with this thing? Because, you know, you're watching these movies, and I started to get really sick to my stomach.
So you went out, you bought some Skittles, you started wandering the streets.
Exactly, and I said, come at me, Zimmerman, and we'll see how this ends. And it would probably end with me dead. But, you know, people would care because I'm white. And that's fundamentally what really upset me about the thing. Like, nobody has to pay for an unarmed kid being dead. And I know this is more serious than it, but I mean, you know what? Fuck it. We need to talk
about this.
Well,
this is the kind of thing where I think, first of all, the jokes are very important.
Yes.
Because it is through jokes that we are ultimately able to tell hard truths. He said, without a hint of a laugh.
I was waiting for the punchline.
There isn't one. This is where the role of the comic becomes so important. And... it's important that we all just start to play with this so that the absurdity of it becomes part of the zeitgeist and not the hostility that racists feel toward non-racists and that non-racists feel toward racists. Because here's the thing. My parents are coming into town next week, and at this time more than any, I need clear, specific instructions on what constitutes manslaughter.
Because this, well, unfortunately, we're not in Florida.
Nor are we legal experts.
But I mean, that's, isn't that the thing, and you were kind of talking about this the other day, Sean.
About the legal justice versus moral justice?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's sort of the absurdity of all of it, is that by the letter of the law, I mean, that the trial was flawed, the case was... prosecution failed. They didn't even invoke stand your ground in any of it. By the letter of the law, what those jurors were asked to determine, he was legally not guilty, but that doesn't expiate the moral guilt of the fact that, like Will said, this kid's dead.
Here's the question. Yeah. Do you want me to get into the heavy shit? Because I don't promise to make jokes if we get into it.
I'm all for it.
Go right ahead.
Okay. The legal system is not designed to produce or provide justice. It has never been designed to produce or provide justice. The legal system is designed to maintain the status quo. And as long as the status quo includes in it racism as part of the fabric of our culture, the legal system will continue to support racism. We cannot pull racism out of the legal structure until we pull it free as a thread in the fabric of our experience.
But can racism be something like something overly subjective, or like when you say that race? Oh, what am I trying to get at here?
I don't.
Is it almost like pornography, where it's like, is racism when you see it? Yeah.
That's the thing. I know they're talking
about. What makes someone a different race? Could we then say George Zimmerman was Latino? Like, where does the racism lie?
We can say
in?
That George Zimmerman was Latino.
Okay, but I guess what I'm saying is you're saying that we need to pull racism out of until racism is gone from the social fabric, we still need to include it in our legal process.
No.
No.
I'm saying that until we can pull it out of the social fabric, it cannot be taken out. I'm not saying it should be in there. I say it cannot be free of it.
Okay.
Because the legal system is not designed toward justice. It's designed toward maintaining the status quo. Always has been.
Okay.
Look, when we moved from feudalism to capitalist democracy, the founding fathers said all men are created equal. Do you know what percentage of adult human beings in the U.S. got to vote at that point?
Either 750,000 or 11 million.
5%.
Wow.
Because you had to be a white
property.
Male
property
owner, and you had to be Christian.
You wouldn't have been able to vote.
True.
Me neither. So,
I own a car. That's property.
No, I don't think having a horse would count. So, So it was 5%. So what they were essentially doing was institutionalizing as the letter of law the status quo. These people who are in power already will remain in power.
Okay.
And then over time, our history, if you read Howard Zinn, the American history is a long series of different groups demanding to be determined by law human beings.
And being included into the system.
Right. Now, so women got to be called human beings, and black people got to be called human beings, and Jews got to be called human beings, and now we're moving toward the place where gays are considered human beings. And yet, the levels of bigotry are still so intrinsic in our social structure that the law continues to preserve them. Until they are removed from the social structure, the law is incapable.
Now, do you think that the outrage over this verdict will instigate more outrage to reform the system or to change laws, or
that's what you got to hope.
Yeah.
I mean, even tonight, I know people are camping out inside Rick Scott, the governor of Florida, his office, and they're not leaving there until they could at least have a meeting about stand your ground laws, which, of course, he's already sent them a letter saying that he will not.
He should have tweeted at them.
He will not consider legislation to get rid of them.
But Holder is now talking about
Holder's
going after stand your ground laws. And Zimmerman today filed suit against Trayvon Martin's parents.
Okay.
For not having control of their kid.
Wasn't he 19?
Really?
Yes.
Here's the thing.
Now, that is the point at which...
It makes it sound like a dog that got off a leash.
Comedy begins to take hold, and the absurdity becomes apparent.
What? I mean, that... it's so frustrating, because I saw the Zimmerman's brother that night. Later, I watched a clip of him that night talking about, I don't know what it is that would make someone like Trayvon be so aggressive against my brother.
Well, what about the quote that the brother said that they actually pointed out on The Daily Show last night, where he says, you know, my brother's probably going to have to wear a bulletproof vest for the rest of his life to protect himself against any crazy armed vigilantes that may come
ahead. Vigilante justice!
And this is why, even though, and I've been on a jury before, and I remember, it was just a DUI case, but I remember we took very seriously, we reread the instructions in the law, and we took it all very seriously, and we had a little, you know, all this legalese. Sometimes it's tough for a layperson to interpret, and we went over it a ton of times, and I'm sure these people did too. But I still feel that if I was on this jury, because it's so clear Zimmerman went at Trayvon with ill will. I don't know if he threw the first punch, but he approached him with ill will, that he was the initial threat in the situation. He was the initial threat to Trayvon, who had every right to be doing what he was doing.
Yes. And a jury of primarily white women who have grown up in a society that has trained them to fear young black men were asked who you would fear more, essentially.
Basically.
And went, oh no, I would be afraid of young black man in a hoodie with his hood up walking at night in my neighborhood. The one juror who has now been interviewed said it was not racial, and George Zimmerman had, you know, his heart in the right place because they had already had trouble from those people.
Yeah.
Which means that Trayvon Martin, by virtue of being a black man in a hoodie, is those people. And according to the law as it was read to them, their job was not to provide justice. It was to maintain the law, which is designed to maintain the status quo, which includes, due to the fabric of society as it exists now, inherent racism.
You know, this is a...
Sometimes I sound like I know what I'm talking about, don't
this
I?
This is a... Remember, people, this is a...
It's a comedy podcast!
We're the funny man!
Each week, we discuss popular culture.
I'm sorry.
But you know what? I brought it up, and I think this is one of those things that if we didn't talk about it this week on the show, it would be like the elephant in the room, because what everyone's talking about. And it does get this idea where I think...
By the way, it's a beautiful elephant you have here, and I think we should talk about your elephant.
We don't talk about the elephant in this room.
But it's
the
a beautiful elephant.
The elephant needs to see a doctor.
Don't listen to him about the elephant. We, but well, I kind of wanted to bring it up originally in the context of entertainment. I wanted to bring it up in the context of entertainment originally.
Quite, yeah.
Of this idea that, is it a good idea?
This is good to know, a man cracking up while you're talking about the racist entrenchment system. One last quick point on this, and this goes back to our original... well, we were talking
what
about
I was about to say.
Yeah, exactly.
what I was in the middle of saying.
Well, the elephant was touching you with its proboscis. Going back to the idea of, yes, trials as entertainment, HLN got a full summer between Jodi Arias and then this. They got a full summer of network programming. And Adam Carolla, who I don't always agree with, but he had an interesting idea vis-a-vis this. He says, you know what? Get the cameras in the room. They get all this free airtime. The courts should auction off the broadcast rights to these trials, and only one network gets to cover it, and they have to pay up some costs, and that covers some of the taxpayer burden that goes into these show trials. I don't think it's a terrible idea.
It would not be a terrible idea, except for this.
Yeah.
What poisons everything is commercialism. Mm. And... you know,
then for it to poison our judicial system.
Yeah, the last thing I want
turned into a reality show.
Yeah, exactly. You know, today's broadcast of the Zimmerman trial is brought to you by
Zaki
Downey
Farms.
Yeah.
And Dow Chemical.
Yeah. Try Xanax. Xanax to help with the anxiety caused by what you're watching right now. Xanax.
I mean, there's something though with these trials.
A lot
trials.
Of feminine
I mean,
hygiene product ads on these, these trials.
It's a good. I mean, is it a good idea? You think though that we do have them
but
on TV?
But good point.
And but I mean, not necessarily paying for them, but that they are on TV. That there's a transparency to the whole process.
We have a transparency. It's called every single word is fucking written down and reported, and it's there. And you know what? Why don't we just write it down, and you can go read the transcript at the end of the day.
That's exactly right. And, you know, I think, and this is so anti-capitalist, I think any show that presents itself as news should not be allowed to use any video footage other than the people who are telling you the facts of what happened.
Yeah.
It's all
commentary.
I am so tired of this thing where... there's important stuff happening in the world, but instead we're going to talk about this fire because the fire keeps you looking at the TV screen.
Cupcakes.
So speaking of light news, speaking of the news they usually prefer to report,
cupcakes
than, like cupcakes. Well, I don't talk about one of my many freelance day jobs. I don't talk about my work here because it's awful, and I just don't want to get into it. And I don't think it's professional. But, as some listeners may have figured out from stories in the past, I work at a network, a television network, that deals a lot with entertainment.
Exclamation point.
And work's been a little rough lately.
Is Dan Barton still there?
Not in whatever department I'm in.
Okay.
Because my department is the worst department.
Oh.
We're in a department in which I sit and I watch said network all day. Just watch it. 24 hours, but someone's watching it 24 hours. And work's been rough lately because...
I've seen that network, and you're certainly not doing quality control.
Hey!
Yeah. Hey!
Actually, I'm not doing quality control. I'm doing something even worse.
Okay.
But we have been... on edge, because there's a baby coming. There is a royal baby coming. And because of this baby, we're all freaking out, and management is freaking out, and everyone's freaking out, because when this baby's born, it is going to be a shitstorm at work. We are going to have to go live. We are going to have to give you the most up-to-date reports. We have people in England who are sitting around just waiting for this baby to be born, and in the meantime, they are interviewing Kate Middleton lookalikes because they have nothing better to do with themselves. They're just waiting. We're under the thumb of this baby. And this isn't the first time recently, because we were under the thumb of another baby. There was some American royalty named Kardashian, and they were going to have a baby, and we had to sit around and wait for that baby. And we just heard that someone else involved in this network has impregnated his wife, a Jonas, which is now finally proof that a Jonas brother has lost his virginity, that his wife is pregnant, and this secures them a new season for their show. So we have to promo that. We're waiting on that baby. We are just waiting on babies. And I am under this tyranny of babies, and I can't take it anymore. I'm going fucking insane, and I'm going to fuck it up. I know that it's going to happen on my shift, and I'm going to fuck all this up, and I'm going to lose my job, and that is why you, Royal Baby, are the enemy of the podcast. Fuck you. You better be born on a day I'm not working. I can't handle this. And the baby might have been born by the time the podcast comes up, because we're recording on a Tuesday. It's up on a Friday. This baby could already be born. But if it isn't, listen later, baby, so you can hear me say, fuck you.
So all this stress is based on the fact that a commoner made shit out the future king or queen of England.
Yes.
In the next week.
Commoner.
Now, Will, do you know the process by which the royal announcement is made when the baby is born?
I thought you were going to ask if you knew the process by which babies were made.
Well,
maybe you could tell me that one next, because I'm a little unclear. But I do not know how this
I believe
goes
there
down.
Will be an easel.
There will be an easel. So normally when a kid is born, you have a tweet or something that goes out.
Yeah, that's how the Kardashians announce.
Exactly.
But traditionally, that's
traditionally,
how the royal family used to do it.
Yield tweet. They would, yeah. It was with an E at the end.
Yeah.
So the doctors in the room will to have the royal child, the royal issue, and then the sex... statistics, all the pertinent information is written down. It is then taken by a courier in an armored transport to, I believe it's St. James's Palace or Westminster Abbey, I'm not quite sure, where it is then posted officially on an easel, and everyone needs to then crowd around and read the handwritten sex of the baby, everything.
So it's like finding out what role you got in the high school play.
That's exactly. If I'd gone to a school with a drama department, that's exactly what it would have been like.
Here's what's so funny about that. You just know the people at this nameless network don't realize this. Even if they do, they're expecting, or their viewers are at least
a press release.
There'll be a press release, a tweet, or something like the same way Kim Kardashian and all these horrible people announced their babies.
Here's the thing about the Kardashians, I just have to say parenthetically, is that they are proof that things that come in threes and things with Ks are hilarious.
Nice.
That's why the KKK is
the funniest
just
organization
so funny. Yeah.
Known to man.
And they also, little known fact, have a fragrance.
The KKK has a fragrance? Wow.
Smoke. Smoke on the water. Fire by the KKK. There's a better gag in there somewhere.
There is. I'm working on it. Yeah. I'm working on it, yeah.
We'll get back to you on that, people.
We'll get back with the funnier joke. But at least the one thing that will be spared is they'll name this kid a normal name, right? It's not going to be like Northwest.
Well, you know, if we really want to get into it, very quickly, if it's a male, it'll probably be named Edward or... It can't be named William, because there's already... Father's Williams, there's already a Henry.
You know,
there's already a Charles.
You can't do a junior?
Not really.
I'm William III.
Yeah, but it's normally not how it goes. Like, King George VI took that name onto himself when he became king. The baby's either going to be named Edward or... Edward or George.
There are betting lines on this in Vegas.
Yeah, and then if it's a girl...
I put all my money on Shlomo.
Shlomo, yeah.
It's very unlikely, but the odds are...
If they want the ultimate fuck you, if it's a girl, there's only been two female monarchs of England. It's Elizabeth and Anne. There's also been Mary, but Mary's a nisht good name because it's Catholic.
If it's female, Diana?
That would be the biggest fuck you to the royal family if they named her Diana.
It's his mother, though.
But they don't...
She's beloved.
She would. They would be the first Queen
she's
Diana.
She's beloved by the people.
Yes.
She is not beloved by the royal family.
Yeah, go back to an institution, which is all about the status quo, by the way. And so Diana, it'd be like the equivalent of having some pope come out and be like, ah, fuck you all, I'm picking a new name. Pope Francis I. Screw all you all. So Queen Diana would be the equivalent of Pope Francis.
Well, then I say, I want Diana now.
I want Diana.
Piss off the old bag.
But I still think Shlomo's a good. I'm putting all my money on
Shlomo.
Yeah. Shimshon Yechiel Windsor.
I mean,
it's a family name. It's
Meyer Windsor.
Meyer Windsor.
We we really are under a tyranny.
I'm the king of carpeting.
Yes,
we really are under a tyranny of celebrity babies.
Oh, no, don't forget Blue Ivy and remember Suri Cruz.
There's a there's like a blog or something. It's like Suri's burn page or whatever, and it's someone writes as Suri Cruz, and she just rips all the other celebrity babies.
That's a hilarious idea.
You're seriously Suri Burns, aren't you?
Oh, I'm gonna check it out when I get home.
No, you are you're the one that's ghost blogging that.
I can neither confirm nor deny. I had this horrible realization last night that at around the time that I am 78, they will be swearing in Senator Honey Boo Boo.
It's interesting.
So just go by Honey Boo at that point. Or Senator Boo.
President Boo. It's interesting that you say this, because there was one last thing I wanted to bring up.
Oh, sorry, yes.
And you've given me the perfect transition.
I strive to not suck.
I always like to end with something weird. And last year, do you watch Game of Thrones, first of all?
No, I have read all of the books and am eagerly awaiting the next one.
Well, you got 12 years?
Yeah, hopefully it comes sooner.
Don't get me started, I'm also...
He's touring, he's doing book signings.
He's morbidly obese.
Will you please write?
He's going to Gandolfini on us.
As someone once wrote, he's...
He's going to do the Robert Jordan thing.
Don't get me started on that.
He's getting older, he's overweight, and he's a Jets fan. And a while back, someone wrote, he's one Mark Sanchez interception away from us never getting the end of Game of Thrones. Well, last year, 146 girls here in America were born given the name Khaleesi.
Awesome.
So it's not, and it, so what's interesting about it, it's not that they even named it after a character. They named it after a word from a made-up language. It's like naming your kid Muggle or something. A Muggle Link. You know?
Well, yeah. There is, speaking of undertones of racism, that character, the idea of the white woman who shows up and rescues the black savages from their heathen way, I am so troubled by that.
But she has dragons, also known as smallpox. Those are her blankets.
Hi, thank you for welcoming me here. Have a blanket.
You just given me a spoiler? Because I haven't read the books.
No, I didn't. No.
Oh, no, we don't know yet.
Okay.
No.
Okay. See, I'm super sensitive to Game of Thrones.
No, I didn't give you a spoiler anything.
Okay.
No.
That was, now
no,
I
No, but
get
you saw like at the end of season 3 when they're all ready to go up like white female Jesus.
You know what's funny? I took what was a funny joke and read it as a spoiler because I'm so paranoid about Game of Thrones spoilers.
Yeah. Sorry. Yes. What was your question?
My question was, basically what you said. I mean, we are going to have last year two of the popular names kids were being born with were Django and Katniss. And actually, Katniss,
cute name.
It's a cute name. It's a fine name.
I don't
for
know what
a
the Hebrew
girl.
Name for Katniss would be though.
So we are going to We're going to have like Senator Katniss, whatever, when we get older, right?
Yes.
Well, you know, after Dr. Zhivago came out, there was a plague of Laras.
Plague of Laras. Yeah. That might be a title.
I think Plague of Laras is playing tonight at the Troub.
Oh, yeah. I love that title, Plague of Laras.
But that's actually it's a good movie. It's a good name. This doesn't bother me so much because I think you need to always inject new blood, or else you end up with King William the Fifth.
Khaleesi sounds like a weird name now, but our grandkids won't think it's weird.
I'm sorry, I wasn't listening. I was injecting new blood.
I mean, do you kind of agree with that? That it's like, some of these baby names seem, like Northwest seems stupid. And what's stupidest about that is they say, oh, we're going to call her Nori. Then just name her Nori. Like, why are you even calling? Because that's like a word that we use.
They had to name her Northwest because they are big fans of One Direction. Thank you! I'll be here all week! One Direction,
well,
I said!
When her fragrance comes out, it's going to be North by Northwest.
Oh, nice.
I cannot take full credit for that joke. That was not mine originally.
But do you have a problem? Would you have a problem with being an old man and voting for
Senator Django?
Yes, Senator Django Unchained.
Senator Django Unchained Meyer. What do you?
Meyer.
I'm just gonna keep going to Meyer. I'm going back to the Meyer well again. I think change is okay. I think it bothers me more that that happened, that they started naming their kids Khaleesi when there was a TV show
and not
when the book came out. You know, that bothers me a little bit.
They didn't
bit.
Know how to pronounce it.
What?
And now they know.
Well, you know, that's so funny. I don't read a lot of fantasy books or anything, but anytime I do, even when I read Hunger Games, I understood how to say Katniss, but there were some names of characters where I had no idea necessarily if I was saying them right in my head, and then I saw the movie, and I go, oh, I wasn't saying that right in my head.
No, the person who decided for the movie made decisions other than yours.
But I assume that the person who wrote the book, when talking about it, she had a way to pronounce it.
Maybe.
Or
that may or may not be the way you pronounced it, and may or may not be the way they did in the movie. You know, I grew up reading the Chronicles of Narnia and the Chronicles of Prydain and all of that stuff, and I, you know, Aslan was my favorite character. And then he became Aslan in the movies, and I went, well, they got that wrong.
Are you a Robert Jordan fan? I've been having this discussion with friends for 20 years. Is it Nineveh or Nynaeve?
Oh, I was pronouncing it Nynaeve.
There we go.
There's a third option.
I don't know. And it doesn't matter because you're reading on the page. Robert Jordan, dying before he finished the series.
We could discuss this offline.
I don't think you've actually talked about this, too, on the podcast.
We can't talk about it offline, but let me say this. Brandon Sanderson missed one of the best things that Jordan was doing literarily.
Which was
partly that. Yeah, Brandon Sanderson went, okay, let's get this over with. But, Jordan was, from character to character, mm-hmm. having a different narrative voice.
Right.
So that the actual narrative voice lived in the head of the characters, and Sanderson did not pick that up nearly well enough. But I've now discovered Brandon Sanderson's writing.
I've heard I haven't read his other stuff, but I heard he's actually pretty
when
good.
When he is writing on his own, boy, do I like his stuff.
The Mistborn books?
The Mistborn books are good. The Way of Kings, which is the first of a new series that he hasn't gotten further with yet,
very,
is
he's
gorgeous.
A great storyteller, and he's a fluid writer.
Sorry.
So.
Yes.
Oh, it's fine.
That was the Robert Jordan digression.
That was the Robert Jordan, Sean's Robert Jordan corner.
But you'll enjoy this. The first time I ever read For Whom the Bell Tolls, I'm like, Robert Jordan? Character's name is Robert Jordan? This is so weird.
That's funny.
Not realizing that worked backwards.
Also, all the controlled dominant stuff that shows up is very sexual.
Oh, the S&M stuff,
When Robert Jordan plays with it, and then Brandon Sanderson is just like, bracelets.
Yeah, but the Mormon doesn't quite know what to do with that.
Yeah.
There's an S&M angle to this?
Oh, yeah.
There's a magical device that if there's a collar and a leash, and when someone is collared, they have absolutely no will. They're absolutely they're submissive to the holder of the leash, and they cannot control their actions. And it's a major issue.
This is part of the story. So this I could get behind. I could get behind this on all ends. And so could former guest Nick Buxom.
Yes, Nikki the Switch.
And possibly former guest Debbie June. What? Maybe I shouldn't have said that. But I did. So, Dylan.
Have I mentioned I love Debbie June?
Debbie June is phenomenal.
She is so funny and so sweet. I adore her.
And now writing on the show The Neighbors.
That's right.
Oh, is she?
Yeah.
Good for her.
Just got that gig. She, since coming on the podcast last summer, where we first really kind of met her, she's become a good friend and supporter of us and our endeavors now going out and performing.
Guided and miss.
Yes. Dylan, thank you so much for coming on this extra innings edition.
You're welcome.
Of the
Are
podcast.
We done?
Yeah,
we're wrapping
wow,
up.
Wow, okay.
I know, it just flies by. Our longest episode ever just flew by.
Cool. Thank you for having me.
I'm so glad
this
you came.
This is good fun.
I'm glad you had a good time.
I'm glad
time.
You did not storm off. Well, actually, we're not finished yet, so.
Thank you, and make sure you thank your assistant for me.
Andrea Marchant.
She, earlier, she was very helpful. Apparently, when you feed the elephant, it insists that you have more food to give it. And she needed to walk the elephant to get it away from me.
She, that's what, honestly, that's the really the only reason we pay her, is to take care of that elephant.
Take care of Julia.
Well, Julia is very sweet, but really, really food obsessed.
You don't want to be around her when she's in heat. Just saying.
Beef gets messy.
How wrong you are, sir!
Before we go, Dylan, do the thing where you plug all your things one more time so the people remember.
My CDs, all available through Amazon and iTunes. The most recent one is Writ Large, all released through Stand Up Records. My new novel, Laughs Last, The Thing of Which I Am Most Proud in the World, is available at Amazon, at Barnes & Noble Online, or you can have it ordered through your local bookstore. My independent feature film, The Dylan Brody Project, will be shooting in autumn or early winter, starring Michelle Martin, in the role of Dylan Brody. That's true.
That's all I need to hear.
You can find out anything you need to find out about me at dylanbrody.com, and you can come to a recording of a show at the Coffee Gallery backstage in Altadena on August 10th. It's called Dylan Brody's Hacking Hollywood. I will be hosting. It is produced by me and Alex Stein, and it is a cavalcade of talent that will go unrecognized unless somebody hacks the system and exposes these people to the world.
And you're on Twitter.
I am on Twitter at Dylan Brody. I am at Facebook at The Dylan Brody. And also, if you go to The Dylan Brody and you tag yourself on the photo of the book cover that is there, you will be entered for a chance to win a signed copy of Laughs Last.
There you go.
Look at that. Sean, why don't you plug some shit?
You can follow me at Twitter at TheSeanDavid. You can also purchase and possibly read my book, Triumvirs, Triumvirs, available for Amazon, Amazon Kindle. I'm also working on a new essay that I will be performing, hopefully at a Tattletales in the near future, but details forthcoming.
Details are sketchy on this one.
They are sketchy. Everything about me is sketchy. You can like my page on Facebook and... I don't know. Find me on various phone games that you can challenge me.
You and your games. You and your letterpress.
Yeah.
Don't play them on it.
But yeah,
don't
follow me on Twitter, because I sometimes engage in bouts of Twitteria.
He sometimes implodes on Twitter, and it's wonderful. And so people have come up to me, and this will make you want to follow him. People have come up to me outraged about what you've tweeted, and my response to them is, then don't fucking follow him.
You can tell when I'm on the toilet, because my output tends to increase.
Fair enough. You can follow me at The Real Will Link. You can also listen to him every Tuesday at 4 p.m. on The PM Show with Larry Minetti at crntalk.com. I review movies and try to explain what Pacific Rim is to a man who doesn't really
know. Who fought in the Pacific.
He spent a lot of time in the Pacific Ocean.
I got a Pacific Rim once.
It was nice.
Oh, that must be something else.
Trip to Thailand.
I wonder if he could. I wonder if Minetti can tell us any stories of his Pacific Rims on.
Oh, back when he was piloting Jaegers.
Magnum. back in his Magnum days. You can also read movie reviews of mine at u1can.com. Can, like the city in France, can.
You have to give that. You have to give that URL again, because you just said you can find it at u1can.
You know what?
And there was no.
I have said this 75 times, and only today have I screwed it up.
Well, then let's give it another run.
We're giving it one more time. You can read reviews of mine and articles at u1can. Can spelled like the city in France. .com.
So
how was that?
Is that you one can like the city in France, all one
type
word?
Type that all in, one thing.
That's why no one's been able to find your article.
I've been typing that in.
L-I-K-E-T-H-E-C-I-T-Y.
I think I've been helpful this whole time. I've been shooting myself in the foot. Also.
KKK perfume, Shrouded Beauty.
Oh, nice.
That's a good one. We knew we'd get one before this
or just Shrouds.
Crossifier.
Crucified.
You will also be able to see me perform at Tattletales Wednesday, July 24th, Shetty's Public Parlor.
I got a hair appointment.
I am reading a essay about love, but mostly about one-night stands and possibly about a woman who tried to urinate in my bathroom sink. Come and find out about it. On the show next week...
Unmasked.
Unmasked.
From KKK.
Sorry. It's usually one word. That's a prom. It's got to be, yeah.
On the show next week. Terrific author. Read his first book just come out a little while ago, which I'm in the middle of reading. John Frechette is coming on the show, and he's going to tell us about his book, The Front Man, which is about a front man in a band, but really it's about how we all are fucked.
And basically. Trying to fuck.
Yes. And the week after that, we have Kevin McGeehan, who hosts a storytelling show called Funny 'Cause It's True. And he's going to be on to tell us all about that. I've seen him perform a few times at Tattletales. Nice guy. We'll see if he comes on the podcast and isn't a nice guy. Maybe he's an asshole. I don't know. We'll find out.
Steve Allen.
Wow, that's a damn endorsement. I've seen him perform a couple of times, and nice guy.
Oh, no, he was very funny. He was very funny. But,
that was probably, should have been a break there. I've seen him perform a couple of times, and he's a nice guy.
Yeah. No, it sounded a lot like, yeah, like you just sacrificed any chance you ever had of getting on his show.
You should have heard the things I said about you before you came on. You should have heard my introductions.
Oh, I will look forward to going back through and listening to it.
How about just Mississippi? And I think on that note,
that's a good one.
Dylan, thank you so much.
We had a great time.
For the Will Sean Podcast, I'm Sean David.
I'm Will Link.
And we're finished.
Mason Dixon from the KKK.